Good evening and welcome to Building Bridges, your community and labor report. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash. Today we have the second part of our special program with Cy Khan. Some people know Cy Khan as an accomplished musician who incorporates his passion for people's rights into his songwriting and performances. His songs of family, community, work, and freedom have been recorded by over 100 artists. But Cy is also an organizer and an author. His new book, The Fox and the Hen House, How Privatization Threatens Democracy, is a proclamation about our democracy and the assault on public services such as Social Security, public schools, health care, welfare, army mess halls, and especially prisons. Cy is the executive director of Grassroots Leadership, a multiracial team of civil rights, labor, and community activists across the South. He also serves as campaign director of the Public Safety and Justice Campaign, a Southern national and international campaign to abolish for-profit private prisons. And now, Cy Khan.
It seems like we're the only country. I mean, you say general strike, you say mass mobilizations. In this country, people look at you like you're crazy. Every other country in the whole world, Canada, Great Britain, France, Italy, India, everybody's going out on these massive mobilization strikes. I'm not even talking about strikes. I'm talking about mobilizations. And here we have a labor movement that wants to have a picket line, a virtual picket line on the web. Why are we so passive? What is your theory of this?
Who do you mean we, brother?
Okay. Call me on that. Okay.
Well, no, that's a fair question.
Yeah, it's a fair question. And I, by the way, I absolutely do not want to leave the impression that this is the culture of the labor movement. I think it's a broad culture within this country, but I think there's some great union locals. I think some great union leadership at the national as well as at the local level. I think there are people who are trying to figure out how you do this and some really fabulous mobilizations that go on. Nonetheless, overall, yeah, what you're saying, I think it has to do with a lot of things. I think we go back to the Red Scares of the 50s and the destruction both of the mainstream labor movement and of the labor left. So that when John L. Lewis left the AFL, when he walked out of the AFL-CIO convention in 1937, very dramatic moment, you know, he hired 1,000 Socialist and Communist Party cadre because they knew how to organize and because they had a politics that he understood. The success of labor in the 30s had a lot to do with hiring organizers who were both very experienced organizers, but also had a set of political beliefs that went beyond the needs of any individual union. Now, these are not things that I'm saying. These are things that you read, right, and that you hear, that there was a time when the main constituency for any union was not just its members. It was working people. And so many trade unionists in the 30s and 40s believed that whatever their particular union and with the responsibility they had to build that union, but they were fighting for all working people, whether they were union members or not. That consciousness has been lost. We call it business unionism, and people are like, no, we fight for our members. Fighting for our members is not enough. I'm a very proud member.
Well, there was a systemic analysis.
Exactly. I think that is a piece of it. And there is an argument that when the labor movement accepted an administrative approach to union organizing, I don't want to get technical, but there was a point where if you wanted a union, you had to strike. And then in the 1930s, as Franklin Roosevelt is trying to rescue capitalism from its own worst excesses and creates the welfare state, this is one of the things that we talk about in The Fox in the Hen House, is these. So part of what happens is that Roosevelt imposes on the labor movement, with the support of the labor movement, elections as a way of building unions. And so we have union representation elections. It becomes an electoral process rather than an organizing process. There's a number of unions that are saying, we're not going to go through that anymore. We're not going through the labor board. We're going to demand recognition in other ways. I think that's very promising. And then it just has to be said, we have been through a 50-year counterattack against the labor movement that has been bitter, entrenched, well-funded, vitriolic, often has crossed legal boundaries. And in The Fox and the Hen House, one of the things we look at are what are historically the barriers to corporate, can we say hegemony on this show, to corporations owning everything and running everything and controlling everything. That's what we're talking about. What are the barriers to corporate expansion and overexpansion? And there really are only three categories, right? One is government itself, through its regulatory powers, through its legislative powers, through its powers of taxation. Government is one of the things in the way of corporations owning everything and running everything. And the corporations have created this privatization agenda, in large part, to get rid of government. They don't want regulations. They want to be able to do whatever they want, however they want, whenever they want to do it. That's one of the counterweights to corporate power. A second one are popular movements, whether it's the civil rights movement, the women's movement, the gay and lesbian movement. These have served often as very, very effective counterweights to corporations. We've seen amazing campaigns, the campaigns to mention the Nestle's campaign, the Walmart campaigns. I don't want to even go through the Gallo boycott for the United Farm Workers under Cesar Chavez. We could go on and on. Then wait and campaigns that have changed laws, changed relationships of power, and have pushed corporations back from where they wanted to be. And then there's the labor movement, which has often been a major force in getting government to change its policies, and is often a major ally of and support to other popular movements. But the labor movement occupies a particular role in the corporate hit list for two reasons. One is because corporations face their workers every day, the power of workers is much more immediate. That's rarely exercised. But a very strong union, as we see in some instances in this country, and you see often in other countries, really gets in the way of a corporation doing what they want to do. I also have as a great gift in my life that I travel. When I go places, I meet amazing people that are doing great work. When you end up, as I often do, in 30, 40 different places in a year, and you go to the listener-supported radio station, you think, oh my God, there are these amazing programs. And yeah, there's Clear Channel, but there's also us. And you go to some of the union halls, you're a part of workshops where people are honestly struggling to deal with race and racism and gender issues. And you sit down with some kids who show up all dressed in black and they know old wobbly songs. And, you know, I think, so I'm sorry, this is a Canadian example, but it happens to be in this country too. I was doing a fundraiser in Winnipeg about 3 weeks ago for the Boreal Alliance. They're working to create what will be the world's largest World Heritage Site, which is 10 million acres, you know, a staggering amount. And the opening act were these two young members, I mean young, maybe 22, 23, 24, members of the Industrial Workers of the World, the IWW, and they had the tattoos and the piercings, they were dressed all in black, and they sang old songs about Emma Goldman, and then they knew the old songs from Joe Hill and the Wobblies, and they had a table with the great literature. I'm not saying, I don't mean to be a Pollyanna. I don't say that it isn't hard times. I just think that there is great work going on in different places, and if we could figure out how to connect it up and get more of it.
Well, you're not a Pollyanna. You're somebody who, and this is the nature of organizing. You can't organize if you don't have essentially a faith and a belief in the human capacity to overcome and to better and to enhance things. And that's how I think of your songs, and that's how I think of your writings and your work with this center. And one of the critical things that you mentioned, which to me is pivotal in the issue of, the whys we don't have the mass movements. And it really, for me, is not about the labor hierarchy. It is much more about the divisions and the refusal, very often, to take from others the experiences and the overcoming and the cultural sensitivities that have mobilized against enormous obstacles, terrifying discrimination. It is about the divisions within racial and national origin. And so I'm particularly glad that you've given that opportunity here to have that discourse, learning that we, white people, are not the center of the universe, that there are lessons and experiences and movements to glean from if we open ourselves up.
Oh, that's good. That's good. We recently lost Rosa Parks, one of our greatest Americans ever. Then there was an outpouring of emotion from expected and unexpected sources in her honor and memory. The Southern Civil Rights Movement, I think, is arguably one of the more profound and world-changing events in our country's history.
Yeah, it broke the back of the police state, among other things.
All kinds of stuff. I started with SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating
Committee. I was leading you there.
There you go. All right. You know, there are many books that really demonstrate that it was almost inevitable. And you can look back now with a distance of history and you can see how it almost had to happen, when and how it happened. For example, the role of the NAACP in the 1930s, and when Ella Baker, coming out of the Harlem rent strikes, went south as a representative for the NAACP, which was an illegal organization. You could be put in prison in Alabama in the 30s for belonging to the NAACP. You look at the role of the Communist Party following 1929, when the Communist Party makes a decision on what's called the Negro National question in those days, and basically says that African-American people people, not called African-American then, but in the United States, were internally colonized people and therefore were appropriate for a national liberation movement within the United States. And organizers were sent into the South to create a consciousness. You can trace the role of A. Philip Randolph and the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters as an African-American-led union, which also created an underground system of communication that black newspapers like the Amsterdam News or the Chicago Defender were secretly distributed by the Pullman porters and dropped off at little towns all through the South and West. You'd see the role of the African-American veterans of World War II, some friends of mine who came back, having been in the trenches in Europe, having been in the fights in the South Pacific, came back thinking how intolerable the system was in the United States, having been in countries where they were not treated with the level and depth of racism they experienced in this country, and how, so you can track all of this. And Rosa Parks appears in 1954, am I right? 57. In Brown versus Board of Education. In The Fox and the Hen House, we quote a poem about the people of Clarendon County, South Carolina, one of the five cases that is consolidated into Brown versus Board of Education, which undoes legal segregation in the United States. So you really can trace an inevitable path. But here's what I find so interesting. I have yet to find a single piece of writing from 1959 back that says in 1960 it will all explode like a raisin in the sun. That in 1960, four students anywhere, they were from Greensboro A&T, who they sit down at a Woolworth counter, nobody predicts that there will be sit-ins in which tens of thousands participate. Nobody predicts that this profound movement will happen. People are working towards something, right? But nobody has called the odds and the shots. And I take hope from this because I think it says that we actually never know when we are on the edge of something powerful, dramatic, revolutionary. I don't think we actually know. So I think we make a mistake if we judge the darkness of the times as the true measure of our condition. Because I think we actually don't know. I think you can argue that in 1959, it looked like legal segregation in the United States would never fall. I think you can make an argument that at that same time, it looked like the apartheid state in South Africa would never crumble, and yet look what happened. So I think the only choice that we have, it may not be a great choice, but it's the only choice is to work in a spirit of hope and to understand that throughout the course of history, no authoritarian regime has ever lasted indefinitely. They always fall. And this is the only way in which I know how to work. So I go out every day and I work in the expectation that we will win. And I don't know when that will comes. The one guarantee that we absolutely have is if we do not struggle against injustice, then nothing ever changes.
So do you want to reach back and pull out one of those wonderful songs?
I read in the paper, I watched on the show. They said that it happened a long time ago. The years had gone by, I just didn't know. Working for freedom now. The songs that we sang still ring in my ears. The hope and the glory, the pain and the fears. I just can't believe it's been 45 years. Working for freedom now. Been a long time, but I keep on trying. For I know where I am bound. Been a hard road, but I don't mind dying. I have seen freedom. Sometimes we stumble, sometimes we fall. Sometimes we stand with our backs to the wall. This road will humble the proudest of all. Working for freedom now. Though the road up ahead may stretch out far and long, we must always remember the roads that we've gone. Memory will help us to keep keeping on, working for freedom now. Been a long time, but I keep on trying, for I know where I am bound. Been a hard road, but I don't mind dying. I have seen freedom.
those who have fallen and given their last have passed on to us what remains of their task, to fight for the future and pray for the past, working for freedom now. The sound of their laughter, the song of their feet, the voice of their praying that cries out in our sleep, will be judged in the end by the faith that we keep. Working for freedom now. Been a long time, but I keep on trying, for I know where I am bound. Been a hard road, but I don't mind dying. I have seen freedom. The wind in the winter is bitter and chill. The cries of the hunted are heard on the hill. I just can't believe there's such suffering still. Working for freedom now. The wind blows the summer from fields far away. We stand in the dust in the heat of the day. Our hearts stop so still that there's nothing to say. Working for freedom now. Been a long time, but I keep on trying, for I know where I am bound. Been a hard road, but I don't mind dying. I have seen freedom.
You evoke something that my mother always reminded me of, and that is it's the process of struggling for what one believes in and understands is right that is liberating, and you help provide that kind of reminder and sense of optimism, and you really do grace us.
Thank you. Thank you. I often will be asked, say, on the air, so you are a topical musician. And they say, so, but basically, you do political music, right? You're a political musician. I said, well, yes, but so is everybody else. I'm like, no, no, you're a political musician because you write songs of protest. I say, actually, I'm for far more things than I'm against. But let's talk about this. I say, for example, do you consider Guns N' Roses a political band? And they say, oh, no, they're a rock and roll band. I say, do you listen to their music? Do you know that they actually have a political point of view? Now, it happens to be misogynist, homophobic, but it is a political point of view. And yet you describe them as, oh, they're just rock and rollers, but I'm political. People who question authority, who question power, get labeled political. It's a form of marginalizing, whereas other bands that are basically reinforcing power, maybe by just saying, hey, just go out and drink, just go out and get drunk, or just go out and dance, they're taking a political stance. So my take is, hey, I am a musician, and what I am resisting is censorship. I do children's songs. I do love songs. I do show songs. I mean, I write all of these genres. I do story songs. I do songs that have a bare minimum of political content in my view. But I also do strike songs. And I also do songs about sexual harassment. And I also do songs about war. But they're a piece of a whole. Love. And I think that our responsibility as people on the left and our responsibility as artists, and I'm not separating, if we're both, we're both, is to paint a full picture of life as it's really experienced by most people. Because that's when they listen to us. They say, whoa, that's about me. Those are the troubles I'm having with my kids. Or, yeah, that's what my birthday party was like. I really like that. Or, yeah, I remember my grandmother. So I think it's not anti-political to be romantic. I don't think it's anti-political to have friends. I don't think it's anti-political to have fun. And to the extent that we seem like, that we seem doctrinaire, that we seem only interested in our political point of view, and we don't reach out to people as human beings, we don't have access to the conversation out of which everybody learns and grows.
To take it back to the book, The Fox and the Hen House, and I was saying to myself, well, he writes differently. This is very different from a lot of the other books on privatization that I've read because it reads really well. It's not like an academic treatise. It's not something that some of the unions put out. It reads like you're talking to people. It's really a very readable book because you do talk about a lot of not just concrete situations, but a lot of situations that are very, very relative to individual people. And it's for that, it's not the usual kind of book of the left.
You two are really nice people. I appreciate all this.
On occasion.
Well, I'm glad I caught you on a good day. No, but this is a high compliment, and it also is really important to me because when Elizabeth Minnick and I set out to write this, we wanted who's going to read a book about privatization? It's like, wow. You know,
my mother is
turning 74. What can I give her that she doesn't have already? A book on privatization. That's exactly there are some mothers who would say, oh, bless your heart, a book on privatization. But, you know, this is a subject that people are not going to read about unless we make it accessible. I think we actually came close, at least from a lot of people have said, you know, I never thought I would read a book about privatization. I never thought I would read a book about policy. But this is kind of fun.
I would advocate that whether you're in junior high school or whether you are an accomplished economist, you
or
can
an accomplished
get
economist
it.
Who is still in junior
right?
high school.
And definitely an activist. And it does tie into, for me, the most important thread, and that is the whole conceptual framework of democracy. And what is democracy? Certainly it's more than a word. And you get it in this book. And I do maintain that has to do with the kind of holistic approach that you have as an organizer, as a creator, as a writer, etc. Both of you, clearly, you and Elizabeth. Oh, and so tremendous compliments on
thank
that.
You.
I just wanted to ask how the book is doing, though, All Fox in the Hen House. How has it been received?
You know, it has been so heartening because so many people have said, I like this book. And, you know, Elizabeth Minnick and I have worked really hard to get it into people's hands. We got an agreement from the publishers to, you know, sell it at a very modest price. It's $14.95 for a really nicely bound quality paperback. But it's everything from, you know, our kids who are like, this is kind of a cool book. You know, I don't know that they've read it all the way through, but, you know, to coworkers. But I think what I like so much is the range. And, you know, the most complimentary thing that people can say to us is, you know, really made me think about things that I hadn't thought about. So I think The Fox in the Hen House, this is a lot of Elizabeth Minnick's influence as a feminist philosopher. It's about helping people think for themselves. I mean, that's what organizers, we want people to act for themselves and think for themselves. Maybe we can actually free ourselves and others.
So let me see if I understand this. In the fight against privatization, you learn about democracy, and you learn about democracy and implement it by empowerment, and then using that empowerment collectively in the aspiration of the working class. And I think you've just tied it all together, and I am going to strongly urge our listeners to get The Fox in the Hen House, How Privatization Threatens Democracy by Cy Kahn and Elizabeth Minnick. And also, how can people get your music?
The Grand Central Station for our lives is thefoxinthehenhouse.com. You can change trains there. You know, one train will take you to elizabethminnick.com. One will take you to grassrootsleadership.org, where I've worked for 25 years, and the organization that really is leading the fight against for-profit private prisons and working for the abolition.
Yes.
That's that word, the abolition of all for-profit private prisons, jails, and detention centers. It'll lead you to psycon.com with free downloads of lots of songs. And The Fox in the Hen House itself, which is, I love this phrase that websites are under construction. I'm like, and where's the Carpenters Union? But eventually we hope to have a bunch of columnists. We've already got Esther Kingston Mann, wonderful historian, is sort of a columnist there. We hope that it'll be a place where the debate around privatization can be engaged. But basically, you know, you go in the front door, you check your track, you choose your train.
And would it be fair, I did say that I'm going to choose one. You have a wonderful song that I downloaded recently that, oh, it looks at, well, the Middle East, all these
the
salient
title,
issues.
The title.
I don't know the
she
title,
do
t- but
I
it says, I'm not interested.
It's a season of peace, season
that's
of war.
The one.
When will these battles divide us no We're, more? Work for the day when all wars will cease. And each day that we live is a season of peace.
Can you take us out with that?
It's got
Cy Kahn.
Season of peace. Stars shining bright. We are at peace with each other tonight.
But in how many places won't we sit at ease? Does the firing of guns break the silence of peace? Season of peace, season of war. When will these battles divide us no more? Work for the day when all wars will cease. Each day that we live is a season of peace. But in how many places do people still fight? Slave against master, black against white. Catholic and Protestant, Muslim and Jew. Friend against neighbor, me against you. Season of peace, season of war. When will these battles divide us no more? Work for the day when all wars will cease. And each day that we live is a season of peace. So shattered and torn, may our hopes be with the season reborn. May we work together with all that we're worth to bring a true season of peace on this earth. Season of peace, season of war. When will these battles divide us no more? Work for the day when all wars will cease. And each day that we live is a season of peace.
That was wonderful.
Sai Khan, thank you for all that you give on a multiplicity of levels. You're a joy to speak with.
Thank you all. Thank you for being here for all of us.
And this has been Building Bridges, Your Community and Labor Report, produced by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. And you can listen to archived Building Bridges programs, including part one of our Sai Khan special, at www.buildingbridgesradio.org. That's www.buildingbridgesradio.org.